All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a deep dive, a really close look at some of the latest and greatest features in Svelte, based on all the stuff in their official documentation. So if you're a Svelte developer, or if you're just curious to see how Svelte's been evolving and how it's becoming even more powerful and streamlined for development, stick with us. This deep dive is for you.
That's right. We've been digging through the latest Svelte docs. We've extracted, I think, the core advancements, and we want to equip you with a solid grasp of these new tools and features, things like reactive props, the new effects system, and the enhanced template syntax, so you can walk away and start building with them right away.
Okay. So to be clear about our sources, we're pulling directly from the official Svelte documentation today, focusing on these new runes, bindable effect, props, stateness. They're kind of a big deal. They represent a pretty significant shift in how we approach building Svelte apps. And we're also going to explore some of Svelte's special elements, the fundamentals of its markup language, what the compiler is doing behind the scenes, and some really interesting changes to the template syntax, like snippets and render tags.
All right, so let's kick things off with how Svelte components receive their data, and that's through props. Svelte 5 introduces this thing called the props rune, and it's the primary way that we declare props. And for those who may not be familiar, props are basically the way that a parent component passes information down to its child components, kind of like attributes on standard HTML elements.
Yeah, so you know, think of a simple example. You have a parent component and you're rendering a user profile component. You might have something like user profile name Alice, age data. Now, inside that user profile component, to actually get access to that name and age data, that's where this props rune comes into play. You do something like let name age data.
Exactly. Very concise, very readable way to pull those props in. And then there are situations where you have a component that needs to accept a kind of variable number of props. Maybe it's passing those props down to another element. In those cases, you can use the REST property syntax. So for example, you might do let primary dot other attributes, which would grab the primary prop specifically, and then everything else would go into this other attributes object, which is really useful for cases where the component itself doesn't need to explicitly know about every single prop. It can just kind of pass those extra ones through.
Really handy.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that the documentation really emphasizes is this reactive nature of props. So if the parent component's age value were to change, that age variable inside our user profile component would also update automatically. That's cool, but there's this really interesting addition. Now a child component can actually have its own local value for a prop, at least temporarily.
Yeah. This is a subtle addition, but it's super powerful for managing what we often call unsaved or ephemeral state within a child component. Imagine a settings panel component, for instance. It gets a theme prop passed down to it. Now, the user might interact with, say, a drop-down menu inside that settings panel to preview different themes. So the settings panel can now keep its own local state variable that's initially set to whatever that incoming theme prop is. So the user can experiment with different theme options locally without immediately affecting the parent component's theme value until they explicitly decide to save.
Well, that's nice. That sounds a lot cleaner than some of the older patterns we might have used for that kind of temporary UI state. But okay, there's this one point that the documentation is pretty firm about.
Yeah.
You shouldn't try to directly mutate regular object props. What does that mean, and why is that a bad idea?
So if you have an object that was passed as a prop and you try to change a property inside that object, it's not going to trigger an update in Svelte. The reason is that Svelte's reactivity system works by tracking when a variable is assigned a new value. But if you're just modifying a property inside an existing object, the object itself hasn't been reassigned. So from Svelte's perspective, nothing's really changed that would require an update.
Okay, so it kind of encourages more immutable data flow pattern, which I guess can make your app state changes a little bit easier to reason about and to debug. Now, what happens if the prop that we're passing down is itself a reactive state variable in the parent, one that was declared using state? What if the child component tries to modify a property of that?
That's a really important distinction. If the parent passes a state variable as a prop, and then the child component does mutate a property on that object, it will cause an update in the parent. However, Svelte is also going to issue a warning, and that warning is called ownership invalid mutation. The reason for that is because the underlying reactive state truly belongs to the component where it was declared. And while it's technically possible for the child to modify it, it's generally a sign that you might need to think about how your state management is structured. It can lead to a lot less clarity about data ownership and can make debugging much harder down the line.
So use it with caution, right? Right. Yeah. It's technically possible, but it might be a sign that you should be structuring your state mm-hmm. differently. All right, let's move on to the whole concept of enabling true two-way communication with the parent component. And this is where Bindable comes in.
Right. Bindable is a really elegant way to create props that support this idea of two-way binding. So instead of data just flowing one way from parent to child, the child can actually directly update the parent's value as well, and vice versa. So you declare a bindable prop like this, let my value by my value by Bing Photo, and then in your template, you can use the bind.directive. A common use case is with input fields. Input bind.value, my value. And with that, any changes that the user makes in that input field are going to update the parent component's value as well.
That's powerful, especially for things like form elements, creating those really nice control components. The documentation also mentions this thing called a fallback value for bindable props. Can you explain how that works?
So in our example, my value equals bindable. That part after the equal sign is our fallback value. So if the parent component doesn't explicitly bind to that prop, then my value in the child component will initially be set to whatever that fallback is. However, and this is important, if the parent does bind to the bindable prop, but it passes undefined as the value, Svelte is going to throw a runtime error. And it does that to prevent confusion about where the source of truth actually lies.
Right, that makes sense. It enforces that if the parent's binding to it, it should be providing an actual value.
Okay.
Lastly, on props, the props rune also provides access to this thing called props.id. When would we use that?
So props.id is really useful for generating unique IDs within a component instance. It's especially important for accessibility. So for example, if you have a label and an input field, you need to link those two together using the for attribute on the label and the id attribute on the input. Props.id gives you an easy way to generate a unique ID that you can use in both places, ensuring that assistive technologies can properly associate them.
All right. So to sum this all up, props in Svelte 5 are about a lot more than just passing data down. They give you this really sophisticated control over data flow and how components communicate with each other. Now, let's talk about Svelte's reactivity system, which is kind of the heart of how it works. We have these two new runes, state and effect. It seems like state is the fundamental building block for declaring a reactive variable.
Yes. If you have a piece of data in your component and you want it to cause an update in the template or maybe trigger some other logic when it changes, you declare it with state. So you would write something like let counter increase state dollars, and that counter variable becomes reactive. The documentation also mentions that you can use state on class properties as well. That can be really useful for organizing state within class-based components.
It's good to see this granular reactivity being supported in those class-based scenarios. So effect is where things get really interesting. It's designed to run code that needs to react to changes in state, whether it's state or even a derived state. How does Svelte know which state changes should trigger an effect to rerun? Does it involve manually specifying dependencies, like in some other frameworks?
So one of the great things about Svelte 5 is that it actually handles dependency tracking for you. It does this by observing which state or derived variables are accessed during an effect's execution. So those become the dependencies of that effect. Then, if any of those dependencies change, Svelte will rerun the effect automatically. Now, there's also this untrack function that lets you access state without adding it as a dependency.
So Svelte's figuring out what you're depending on just by analyzing what you're using inside the effect. Mm-hmm. That sounds way less error-prone than manually maintaining dependency arrays. So when exactly do these effects actually run?
Well, an effect will run initially after the component has mounted to the DOM, and after that, it'll rerun whenever any of its dependencies change. But importantly, Svelte batches these updates together. So if multiple state variables change, all the affected effects will be queued up and run in one go. This is called a microtask, and it ensures that all the updates happen efficiently before the user sees any visual changes.
Excellent for performance. Mm-hmm. The documentation mentions that you can also put effect inside another effect. What does that imply about how effects are handled?
Well, it highlights the fact that even Svelte's internal reactivity system, the stuff that powers how the template updates when a state variable changes, is also built on this whole effects mechanism. So when you have an expression in your template like h1 hello name.h1, the updating of that h1 when the name variable changes is actually being driven by effects behind the scenes. But while you can nest effects, be cautious. It can sometimes make your logic a lot harder to follow.
Right. So under the hood, the templating system's also using effects. Cool. Now, a key aspect of any reactivity system is cleanup. We need to make sure that if an effect sets up things like timers or event listeners, we properly clean those up when they're no longer needed. Does effect provide a mechanism for that?
It does. Effect can return what's called a teardown function. And that function gets executed just before the effect runs again because of a dependency change, or when the component itself is being destroyed. This is important for things like clearing intervals or timers, removing event listeners that you might have attached, or unsubscribing from any external data streams. The documentation even has a good example of using set interval and then its corresponding clear interval for cleanup within an effect.
Got it. It's essential for preventing memory leaks and keeping our components tidy. Now, are there any kind of gotchas or common pitfalls we should be aware of when working with effects?
Yeah, one of the most important things to keep in mind is that anything you do synchronously, like reading a state variable inside a set timeout callback or after an await, those things are not automatically tracked by effect. Svelte's dependency tracking happens synchronously. So if your effect sets up a timeout and then you try to access a state variable inside that timeout callback, changes to that state variable aren't going to trigger the effect to rerun.
That makes sense. It's watching the immediate synchronous flow of execution. The docs also point out that an effect only reruns if the identity of a reactive object changes, not just if a property inside it changes. That feels like a really important distinction to understand.
Absolutely. So if you have a reactive object that's declared with state, and you have an effect that depends on that entire object, the effect will only rerun if you actually assign a new object to that variable. Just changing a property inside the existing object won't trigger the effect unless your effect was specifically looking at that particular property. Now, for debugging, there's this really useful inspect rune. If you need to watch what's happening inside an object as it changes, inspect can give you a lot more detailed information.
So that's good to have in our debugging toolkit. It seems like it's easy to create infinite loops if you're not careful about how you're reading and writing to state within an effect.
Right. You got to be careful. If you have an effect that's updating a state variable and then that same variable is also one of the dependencies of that effect, you can get yourself stuck in an infinite loop. The documentation actually shows this with a clear example using total, spent, and left calculations, where the effects keep triggering each other over and over again. The best way to avoid that is to use things like event handlers or function bindings to control the updates more explicitly.
So use that more direct control when you need to avoid those accidental feedback loops.
All right, effect.pre is another thing the docs mentioned. How does this one work differently from a regular effect?
So a regular effect runs after the component has been mounted and after any updates to the DOM that might have happened due to changes in state. But effect.pre runs before any DOM updates in the current reactive cycle. It can be useful for scenarios where you need to calculate something or adjust something that might influence how the DOM is rendered. Think of it as having access to the state right before any visual changes happen.
Interesting. A hook into that moment right before the visual updates. And finally, there's effect.tracking. This one sounds even more advanced.
Yeah, effect.tracking is a function that tells you whether or not the code it's being called from is currently running inside an active-reactive tracking context. This is really useful when you have more complex scenarios where you need to execute certain logic only if you're inside something like an effect or a reactive part of your template. That's a lot to take in about reactivity in Svelte 5. Seems like a very powerful and nuanced system. Let's move on and talk about the way we actually pass data and render elements within our Svelte components.
Yeah.
We've already talked about passing props using attributes and that name shorthand syntax.
Right. And we also talked about the spread attribute syntax, where you can do something like dot props. That's really handy when you need to pass a bunch of props down in one go. Maybe you're just forwarding them to a child component.
Now, what about situations where we might not actually know the specific HTML element that we need to render ahead of time? For example, if we're getting data from an API or a CMS, that's where svelte.elements expression comes in, right?
Exactly. So svelte.element lets you dynamically render any HTML element based on a JavaScript expression. You assign the expression to this attribute. This is super useful when you're dealing with dynamic data. The documentation does mention some limitations, though. The only binding that's supported on svelte.element is bind.this, and that's because we're dealing with an element that we don't know ahead of time. Also, if the expression for this evaluates to null or undefined, Svelte's just not going to render anything at all.
And there's a specific note about potential issues with void elements.
Right, void elements. Those are the elements in HTML that can't have any content inside them, things like bra or MMG. So if svelte.element ends up rendering a void element, and you've put some content inside those tags in your template, Svelte's going to throw an error in development mode. And sometimes, especially if you're working with SVGs, you'll need to use the XMLENDS attribute to make sure you have the right XML namespace on the element. Oh, and also that expression for this, it has to resolve to a proper DOM tag name. You can't use it to render things like text nodes or other special spell elements.
Okay, so it's specifically for rendering those dynamic HTML elements. Then there's svelte.options custom element. My custom element. That sounds like it's for creating custom elements, right?
Yes, that's exactly what it's for. When you compile a svelte component as a custom element, this is how you define the tag name that you'll use for that element in your HTML. Svelte also provides svelte.body, which is for attaching event listeners or using actions on the body element directly. And there's svelte.boundary for creating those special components that help you handle errors gracefully if things go wrong during rendering.
So Svelte gives us these little entry points for working directly with the DOM and the way components get created and destroyed. Now back to the basic building blocks of our Scala templates. Just a quick reminder, lowercase tags are always HTML elements, and uppercase or dot notation tags are our Svelte components.
Exactly, the fundamentals. And when it comes to attributes on those elements, they work pretty much like you'd expect in HTML. You can use unquoted attribute values, which is nice. And importantly, you can embed JavaScript expressions inside attributes using those curly braces. Now, Boolean attributes, they're a little special. If their value is falsy, the attribute won't even be included in the final HTML. For other types of attributes, they're included unless the value is explicitly null or undefined.
Right. So those attributes are how we're passing props to our Svelte components. And the name shorthand is really convenient when the attribute name and the JavaScript variable name are the same. We've also talked about those spread attributes where you can do props. And of course, to build anything interactive, we need to handle events. In Svelte, that's the on.eventHandler syntax.
Yep. And one thing to remember, the event name in on.event is case sensitive. You can also use shorthands for common events like onClick, which is just a nicer way to write on.click. And you can spread listener attributes as well, which is really helpful for grouping handlers together. Behind the scenes, Svelte's actually doing this really smart optimization called event delegation for many common events.
Ah, event delegation.
Yeah.
Just for our listeners who might not be as familiar, can you explain why that's so beneficial?
Sure. So instead of attaching an event listener to every single element that might trigger an event like click, Svelte often attaches a single listener at a higher level in the DOM, maybe at the root of the component. And then when an event occurs, it bubbles up the DOM tree. That single listener intercepts it, and Svelte checks if there's a corresponding handler on the element that actually triggered the event. It's a huge performance win, especially in apps with a ton of interactive elements. There are a couple of things to be careful about, though. If you're manually dispatching an event that you want to be handled by Svelte's delegation system, you need to make sure it's set to bubble up the DOM. And if you call stop propagation on an event, it might prevent Svelte's delegated handler from seeing it. If you need really fine-grained control over event propagation, Svelte recommends using the on function from the Svelte events module. It's just more robust. Also, for performance on touch devices, events like touch start and touch move are treated as passive listeners by default.
Got it. Lots of performance considerations there.
Mm.
Back to the template syntax. To output dynamic content, we have text expressions, just regular JavaScript inside curly braces.
Yep. And Svelte takes care of converting the result to a string. And it also escapes any HTML characters, so you don't have to worry about things like cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. But if you do need to output raw HTML, you can use @HTML, potentially unsafe HTML string. Just be very careful with that one. Make absolutely sure the HTML you're rendering is from a trusted source.
Right, a very powerful feature, but definitely use it responsibly. And finally, for basic markup, there are HTML comments and then Svelte-specific comments like svelte_ignore and @component.
Standard HTML comments, those are those work just like you'd expect. The Svelte ignore comment is for when Svelte gives you a warning, but you know you're doing the right thing and you just want to quiet down that specific warning. And then @component, that's a documentation comment. So if you're looking at your code in an editor that supports Svelte, hovering over a component will often show you that @component comment, which is great for inline documentation.
Cool. Let's move on to some more advanced features. We have these things called snippets and render tags. It sounds like snippets are a way to define reusable blocks of HTML within our components.
You got it. They're kind of like reusable functions, but for markup, you define them with the syntax snippet name, param1, param2 dot snippet, and then you can insert them anywhere in your template using @RenderName, arg1, arg2. Super helpful for avoiding repetition and making templates a lot more maintainable. Snippets can even accept parameters, and you can give those parameters default values. They also support destructuring for object and array arguments, but no rest parameters just yet.
Can snippets be nested, or even recursive? Can we build up more complex patterns that way?
Totally. There's an awesome example in the documentation of a countdown snippet that actually calls itself to create a countdown timer. That opens up all sorts of possibilities for complex UI patterns without having to write tons of repetitive code. It's important to remember, though, the scoping of variables. A snippet can only access variables that are in scope where the snippet is defined, not where it's rendered.
Yeah, makes sense. What about passing snippets around? Can we pass a snippet to another component as a prop?
Absolutely. Snippets are just values in Svelte, so you can treat them like data or functions. You can pass them down to child components as props. And here's a really cool trick. If you define a snippet directly inside a component's template, it automatically becomes a prop on that component with the same name as the snippet. In a way, snippets are kind of like the modern replacement for slots in Svelte. They're more flexible, more powerful. And for super advanced cases, you can even create snippets programmatically with this function called create a raw snippet.
All right, that's a really nice way to structure reusable logic within our templates. Let's move on to debugging. Sullen provides a special @debug.tag. How do we use that?
Yeah, @debug is really helpful for debugging. It's kind of like an alternative to putting console.log everywhere in your code. You can use it to log the values of variables, and it'll only log them when they change. And the best part is that if you have your browser's developer tools open, it will actually pause execution right at @debug tag. So you can inspect the current state of your app, look at all the variables, and really see what's happening step by step. But keep in mind, you have to pass in a comma-separated list of variable names to @debug. You can't put in arbitrary expressions. And if you use @debug with no arguments, it acts like a debugger statement. It will pause execution whenever any state changes in your component.
That's an awesome feature. Makes debugging much easier. So moving on, we have some other key Svelte directives and attributes we've already talked about on for event handling and bind, for two-way data binding. What else should we know about?
Okay, there's class. This one's for adding or removing CSS classes from elements based on JavaScript expressions. And it's flexible. You can pass it a string, an array of class names, or even an object where the keys are the class names and the values are Boolean expressions that control whether the class should be applied. Then there's style. This one lets you set inline styles dynamically. And it even supports the important modifier if you need to override other styles.
Yes.
Also good to know. Style. Directives have higher priority than regular style attributes that you might have in your HTML.
Good to keep that precedence in mind. What about animations? Svelte provides transition and animate. When do we use each one?
Transition is for creating those smooth visual effects when an element enters or leaves the DOM. It's often used with conditional rendering, like if blocks. By default, transitions work in both directions, so if you remove an element while it's still transitioning in, it'll reverse the animation smoothly. Svelte has some built-in transitions, but you can also create your own. And you can define your own custom functions that control exactly how the animation progresses, frame by frame. Transitions can also be local to the element they're applied to, or they can be global, affecting all transitions in component or even the entire app. Oh, and they also fire off events like intra-start, intra-end, outer-start, and out-end that you can listen to.
So transition is for elements appearing and disappearing. Animate-add is different, right?
Yeah, animate is specifically for when the order of items in a list changes. So it's really useful with key tag each blocks. It doesn't trigger if you add or remove items, only when their position in the list changes. Svelte has some built-in functions for common animations, but you can also create your own, giving you a lot of control.
Got it. Transition. For appearing and disappearing, animate, for list reordering. What about the use? Directive.
Followers is for what Svelte calls actions. Mm. An action is basically a function that you can attach to an element and it gets called when the element is created. You can even have it return a cleanup function that runs when the element is destroyed. Actions are super powerful for encapsulating reusable logic that works directly with DOM elements.
All right. We've covered a lot of ground here. Let's briefly touch on Svelte's control flow structures. We have htag ag and tag await, hashtag await, all pretty intuitive for anyone who's worked with templating languages.
Yes. If does exactly what you'd expect. Conditional rendering, and it supports ifs and else branches. Each is for looping over arrays or even array-like objects and iterables. It gives you access to the current item, its index, and you can even provide a unique key for each item. Really helps Svelte update things efficiently. And you can use destructuring right in the each statement, which is super convenient. There's even an optional else block that renders when the list is empty. Oh, and Svelte provides a shorthand for just rendering something a certain number of times, like each LinkedIn, and then there's await. That's specifically for handling promises. It lets you render different content based on whether the promise is pending, resolved, or rejected. And it even has shorthands if you only need to deal with the success or error case.
Makes sense. Now let's talk about Svelte's compiler. It's known for being really helpful, and the documentation highlights compiler errors and warnings. Can you give us a feel for the kinds of feedback it provides?
Yeah, Svelte's compiler is really good at catching potential problems. It's looking at your code as you write it, and if it finds anything that's going to prevent your component from working, it'll give you a nice, detailed error message. And these errors cover a huge range of issues, from simple syntax errors to problems with bindings, missing closing tags, all kinds of stuff. Beyond that, Svelte also gives you warnings, and these are for things that might not be technically wrong, but they might be signs of accessibility problems, performance issues, or just code that's not doing what you intend. And the great thing is you can even suppress specific warnings using those Svelte ignore comments if you need to.
It's like having a second pair of eyes on your code, constantly looking for potential improvements. The documentation also mentions runtime warnings, which I guess happen in the browser. What kinds of things do those typically flag?
Right. Runtime warnings happen while your app is running, and they usually point to situations where Svelte detects something that might not be what you intended, like maybe you're trying to update a reactor property with a value that's already out of date, or if you're modifying a state variable that belongs to another component, which is that ownership invalid mutation warning we talked about earlier. You also get warnings for mismatches between what was server rendered and what's happening on the client.
Okay, so Svelte's giving us feedback at every stage of the process. Now let's talk about sharing data between components, especially when we don't want to pass props through a ton of levels. This is where Svelte Context API comes in.
The Context API is all about providing a way for a parent component to make a value available to any of its descendants, no matter how deep they are in the component tree. So it's a really nice alternative to prop drilling, where you're passing props through components that don't even need those props themselves. It works with these two functions, setContext and getContext. The parent uses setContext to associate a value with a specific key, and then any child component can use getContext with that same key to retrieve that value. It's important to understand that context is local to the component tree where it's set up. It's not a global state solution.
Right. So it's like a little contained environment for sharing data down a specific branch of components. We also mentioned custom elements and Svelte's ability to compile components into custom elements. What are the key things to keep in mind there?
Okay. So when you compile a Svelte component as a custom element, the component's props become properties of the resulting custom element. And where possible, those props are also reflected as attributes on the custom element itself. Now, the lifecycle of a custom element created with Svelte is a bit different. When the browser creates your custom element, its connected callback runs. But the actual Svelte component instance isn't created until the very next microtask. This can be a little tricky if you're setting properties on the custom element before it's actually connected to the DOM.
What about limitations or things to watch out for when using Svelte to build custom elements?
There are a few. So by default, Svelte uses Shadow DOM to keep the styles of your custom element contained. That means global styles or even those .global styles from your component aren't going to apply automatically. Also, your component styles are usually inlined in the JavaScript. They don't become a separate CSS file. And custom elements aren't always the best choice if you're doing a lot of server-side rendering because the content inside the Shadow DOM isn't really available until the browser runs the JavaScript. Also, the way slots work is a bit different. Svelte renders them lazily, so only when they're needed, and the let directive doesn't work with them. You'll probably need polyfills for older browsers, and the context API is scoped to the Svelte world. It doesn't work across custom elements. Oh, and avoid using prop names that start with on. They might confuse the browser.
Good to know. What about styling within Svelte components? Are there ways to apply styles globally or to target specific elements outside of the component?
If you need a keyframes animation that's available globally, you can prefix the name with left global, and then Svelte will take care of removing that prefix during compilation. For targeting any element, even outside of the component scope, there's the .global selector. We already talked about that one. And one final thing to remember, Svelte main might add some wrapper elements around parts of your template to keep styles contained. It doesn't usually affect layout, but it's something to be aware of if you're writing really specific CSS selectors.
Okay, good to know. We haven't talked about lifecycle hooks like onMount and onDestroy in detail today, but they're still a key part of Svelte, right?
Oh, absolutely. Lifecycle hooks are still there, and they're essential for managing side effects, dealing with resources, and running setup or cleanup code. They haven't gone away, even with all these awesome new features.
Wow. We covered so much ground in this deep dive.
We did. So, just to sum things up, Svelte 5 has these really powerful new features like Props, state, effect, and bindable. They give you amazing control over reactivity and component APIs. And then we have snippets and render tags for more flexible template logic, a super helpful compiler, and even the ability to build custom elements with Svelte.
And for you, our listener, I hope this is giving you a really good overview of